Ilya, we're in your installation here at the ICA, and it's titled The Untalented Artist and Other Characters, and it consists of a series of room spaces that have been cordoned off, divided, and a lot of other elements that look rather like the debris from a building site or a building. And in the catalogue you talk, I think, very vividly of the Soviet apartment. And I thought it would be interesting to start off by you perhaps explaining a bit more about what clearly is a very strong relationship that you have with the experience of having lived within apartments in Moscow.
Дело в том, что я не хочу в этой коммуналке
изобразить a communal apartment and about the details of living in one. It's not actually meant to represent the real thing. He really wants to talk about other things in his work. It's not actually, as again, to depict the sort of ethnic quality of what it's all about, living in a communal apartment. But it does have some aspects of it that are being demonstrated. It's a more general question about closing a person into, or about a person having to live in the space of four walls, and how he actually communicates with other people and has contact with other people in this situation. A perfect situation for constant exchange and contact with always being surrounded by other people. So the individual has to find some kind of way of maintaining his personal self separate from this huge sea of people around him. The communal apartment is more a depiction of the how a person mixes and how he protects himself from those around him.
So in a way, the apartment is merely being used metaphorically as a way of exploring the human condition within certain situations, because it seems to, the installations here seem to be inhabited by, on the one hand, comic characters, on the other hand, very tragic characters, but there is a sense of the private here, the withdrawing into a private space.
There's another important sort of metaphor in the situation that in a communal apartment, nobody chooses their neighbours. They're just thrown together and they have to live with them as they find them. The communal apartment divides into two parts, really, the corridor and the separate rooms where people live privately or separately, have their own area, and the communal kitchen, which is a kind of battleground where there's constant exchange and contact. Sadly, there isn't the communal kitchen in this installation. It doesn't have a part in it. I hope that in New York, in the Feldman Gallery, they will be able to put together the whole thing with the communal apartment, with the kitchen and all the rooms and corridor.
In a way, reading Ilya's description of the communal sort of flats that clearly has some experience of, there is a sort of Kafkaesque sense there, and I was wondering whether the installations here, based around characters, was in a way an attempt both to escape from what is an overbearing sort of structure, social, cultural structure, into a more private, more real world by analysing and making manifest every aspect of one's existence, right down to the debris that we all have and use. We're actually looking at one of the rooms here, which is the man who never threw away anything, and it seems to me a way of sort of substantiating an existence.
This is absolutely true.
Should we just walk around some of the other ones? Let's just walk through. This interior is, the title of it is The Man Who Flew Into Space From His Apartment. And it's rather like a cell with a seating contraption that looks as though it could launch somebody. And in fact, indeed, there is a hole in the ceiling of this cell where someone could have actually been projected through. Otherwise, the floor is full of builder's rubble or rubble from the hole in the ceiling, and various objects that seem to me to, rather like a lot of the other rooms, evoke the presence of a human being. There's a sense of a presence here.
This room is always, every room is always like a prison in a way to a person. If you live in a room, to get into the outside world seems to be your ultimate desire. And if he wants to, he can actually just go out of the room into the corridor and into the kitchen to meet other people. The corridor and the kitchen are like the outside world to him, from which he escapes. This outside world of the communal apartment is not adequate to him, and he wants to escape the whole of that, to get right out of it. So the cosmos or the space that he wants to get out into is for him like some kind of other world, some heaven, some wonderful place, some paradise.
I mean, in that respect, it opens up, I suppose, issues to do with the artist's relationship to the state, which clearly one has to deal with, I think, when looking at the work, certainly within this British context.
Нет, это не кажется.
He doesn't think that that's right, really. He's not arguing, but he doesn't really feel it touches him. This is the...
Здесь скорее та самая притча, попытки.
It's more about an attempt to trying to get into the other world by your own means. Yeah. And although this character has tried to get into the other world by this crazy invention, it has a kind of pathos because it's obviously not adequate to get him into
it.
It seems to us that it's silly and comic and, you know, idiotic, but on the other hand, when he flew away, nobody found him on the earth afterwards, and so it may have been a successful experiment. Mm-hmm. We've no proof against, you know, mm-hmm. to the contrary. So it's an open question. Mm-hmm. It seems just crazy, but mm-hmm. it may have been successful.
Mm. Okay, should we move along to this next mm-hmm. one? Right, sorry. This is again an enclosure with the title The Short Man, and in fact I saw the Riverside installation too, where you have a maze of facets of books from that are narratives, in fact. I mean, one thing that also interests me is the sort of relationships between what clearly are autobiographical experiences, but in a way expressed through a third party.
Mm. This room is really has three characters in a way that work in it. There's the short man who put the thing together, who composed it. There's Ilya's drawings in it. But there's also another character who thought up the installation as a whole came from this short man. So there's a sort of three characters all working at once, and it's not clear which one is the main character, whether it's the artist or whether it's one of the characters invented or whether the further character that sort of emerged and created the whole.
Right. As we're sort of standing now within the main section of the gallery, which in fact, rather like Riverside, you haven't been content to just leave the gallery as a sort of a shrine-like space that it normally is. You've actually painted it here rather like an institutional building with a colour halfway up the wall, and at Riverside you've covered halfway up the wall with a sort of a matchboarding plastic. And there's paintings sort of leaning against the wall, and through the centre there's, as I was saying earlier, the paraphernalia of decorating and building within a house. And there is a sense of the incomplete, as though something started but hasn't finished. I was wondering if Ilya could actually talk a little bit about that sense of the unfinished.
He's saying that this uncertainty about whether something is being in the process of being built or in the process of being taken apart and thrown away is very elemental in the way the criminal apartment functions. There's a sense of movement all the time, but never knowing which direction you're going in. That when he actually put together this installation, he never really knew whether it was going to be built any further than it is, or if it was going to be taken down. On at what point that feeling begins is unclear as well, because when you're building something, there's always rubbish, and when you're taking something away, there's always rubbish, and the rubbish is very much a sort of symbol of this uncertainty of movement. The rubbish is a symbol not only of this sort of ruin and destruction and entropy, but also it has a particular potential, because all these people's lives are really basically a clutter of things that they've drawn things out of the rubbish to make their own lives, and so the rubbish has a sort of capacity to go either way. It's sort of neutral, but a symbol of both things, of destruction and construction.
Yeah.
There is always the chance that nothing except a lot of rubbish comes out of it.
Now in the space between the galleries here upstairs at the ICA, the composer who combined music with things and images, and I'm reminded of one of the stories in the book of a concert in an apartment or in the corridor of an apartment and the ensuing complaints that were documented. And I think you...
It's the same.
And you spoke of the desire to bring something within this very confined space that had some sort of cultural resonance. Perhaps you could elaborate on this piece.
This character who's very upset about the fact that people were just interested in doing the washing up and the saucepans and running around and not actually thinking about culture at all or having any cultural part in their lives. He wanted to force them to think about, well, encourage them to think about something rather sort of more highbrow. So he got them all together to sing in a choir. Put together all this combination of pictures and text. It was very difficult to actually stop people rushing about and to actually get them all together. So he stopped them by actually putting up the stands in the corridor so that they couldn't actually run about. It was a way to compel them to join in. Terrible rows occurred and fights and everything just went complete. it's a sort of fable about how other people drive one another to their deaths, really.
On this occasion, perhaps through culture.
No, it's через культуру. Of course.
What I find very interesting about the work is that although it's clearly derived from a very specific experience that clearly would be removed from a sort of a Western audience or a Western society, it still seems to me to speak in a sort of universal language in relation to sort of the human condition through the use of sort of metaphor and symbol and so on. And I think that it deals with issues such as private spaces as opposed to overwhelming social pressures, political pressures of whatever order. You know, there is a sense of the private or the personal survival, or there is a sense of personal survival being kind of investigated here.
There was a problem with the installation that people, it was really rather difficult to get people to understand what a communal apartment was and why, if it was so awful, people actually lived in it. But there is something of this, a sort of consideration of these more general issues are definitely there. A very successful metaphor of life, of human existence.
Но с другой стороны, невозможно сделать привязано к той реальности, которая.
This can't really be conveyed in something abstract. It has to be portrayed in something that the artist knows extremely well as a reality. If you have a really pure metaphor, then it loses its bearing on anything real. Whereas if you use something that's straight from reality, then it'll seem too autobiographical and not referring to other things. And he hopes that this installation has somehow sort of fallen between the two.
How would you locate yourself, Ilya, within Soviet art? I mean, would you see yourself as belonging to a some tradition, some line of development or area of concern within Soviet art?
There's from avant-garde art, there was a big... Well, there was avant-garde art which suddenly came to an end and didn't seem to have any direction going further. And then there was socialist realism, which came to its own end as well. And then at the end of the 50s, unofficial art emerged. And Ilya sees himself as part of the unofficial culture. But he says that some people see that as having already come to an end now. See these three different movements as being directly connected one to the other.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting, the idea of unofficial, because if there ceases to be an official, then what is the unofficial?
It always has existed and it always will, it just have a different name. You speak of socialist realism, now they call it something else.
Just very finally, the last question. Are there any sort of Western artists that have been particularly important to you? I mean, in the area of using one's experience and developing it into installation, one thinks of Boyce. I mean, Western artists, have they had any sort of an influence, do you think?
Really hard to say that they are influenced, because they're so isolated and they only had acquaintance with Western art through sort of little cuttings and magazines and bits and pieces, nothing really general. Only when they came to the West did they really have... they're actually able to see these works and have real contact with them. But he feels that there may be certain parallels in art, because things emerge, things are so universal that they come out of their own accord, really, in art or in an artist, that they develop by themselves. It's possible that a similar situation will provoke similar sort of artwork. This is that there's just one thing about the installation that he feels hasn't really worked, is that this is only part of the installation, I guess, because the communal kitchen isn't in it, and so the whole message is not conveyed. It would only be this whole world of its own would be recreated only if you have the whole installation. Okay.
Well, now I'm downstairs at the ICA talking to Eric Bulatov, and you're exhibiting a series of quite large paintings here, Eric. And perhaps I could start by asking, perhaps you'll think it a rather obvious question, but I think it's interesting nevertheless from my perspective. Can we start by discussing the context within which you have worked as an artist, that is, in Soviet Russia? And I know that now with Perestroika the situation is changing, but I'm particularly interested in asking you to define the relationships between your work, its intentions, and the social, cultural context within which you've lived. I think it's particularly interesting given the use of Soviet iconography in your work.
It says that his... what he's depicting is an image of what he actually sees in his life. It's not a criticism or an evaluation. It is simply exactly what he sees around him, how it presents itself to him. And by painting what he sees, he somehow achieves a kind of freedom from these surroundings by putting a distance between himself and them, the painting representing that distance. But there's no irony in the work. It's not a kind of criticism.
Can we now talk more specifically about the paintings? There are recurrent themes, such as a concern for light, for space, pictorial depth, also a combination of text with imagery. And in fact, we're looking at a painting here on the left, which is Glory to the CPSU, which again reflects this concern that you have that goes through a lot of the works, that is of spatial landscape, in this case it's clouds, with typography that's actually on the surface of the canvas. And perhaps you could, you know, talk about these issues that obviously preoccupy you in most of the work you do.
The important thing for him is to present a picture rather than a landscape. That it's not to be regarded as a landscape, but a picture, like, I suppose, an icon. The picture doesn't have a kind of hermetic quality. It's not hidden or closed. It's open. It's an open space. There are two spaces. There's the space of the picture and there's the space of life. And what he tries to do in painting is to put the problems of his life into... take them out of the space of his life and put them into the space of the picture. So he's saying that the letters, and particularly the red letters, are a kind of social aspect from life that appear on one surface of the picture's space, and then there are other things on the other surface. So he's saying that the letters that are on this surface, this outward surface of the picture, act are like something, a very aggressive force, and they act straight onto us. They come and hit our minds very directly. But they're one-dimensional. They're very thin, only sort of, you know, as thin as the canvas, and they don't go back into the depth of the picture.
Yes, if I could just explore the relationship between the text and the imagery. I mean, the imagery is quite specifically figurative and representational painting, and the text seems to impose upon it in quite a powerful, dominant way. Is the text there to fix the meaning or to extend the ambiguities of the painting?
It's as if there are two two sort of characters working in together in the picture. The letters are one and the sky is another, and the letters come out into the limited area of social existence, into our world, which is limited, and the letters represent that limitation, and the other side is the sky, which just belongs to the other side of the picture. He says belongs to the sky,
which represents the infinite, the unobtainable, or the future. Or
the sky represents space, which is unlimited, really, whereas the letters represent this other space, which is aggressive. The social space. But there is on the other hand, there's the picture, I don't know if you saw the picture, that says entry and no entry, both at the same time, that these two things do exist simultaneously, and they're not one after the other, or they're actually there together. So they represent both spaces together.
Well, now we're looking at a painting which is a portrait of the poet Nekrasov. I'm very interested in this painting because it seems to be mediated in terms of the way it's been expressed. It's rather like a very pale photographic representation.
He'd like to, first of all, the main thing is that when he paints, he tries very hard not to paint things as he sees them, and particularly in a style that is very ordinary. And there's a Russian word, poshly, which means kind of dull and vulgar. And he tries to represent things in this way, and to use a style that is suited to that method. And this, in this picture, he's represented this poet as if he were just some. I mean, he looks like he might be anybody, just a worker. It's a very simple sort of representation. But the light that goes across the picture gives it a special sort of quality, an almost sort of poetic quality, like of language, that gives it something rather particular. And he wants to talk about the other pictures. His work as this poet is very important for Bulatov and his work.
Yes, I was going to ask if he could talk about the importance of the poet.
For him, this artist works with language. So this poet works with language in the same way that Bulatov works with objects. That he uses language rather than ordinary everyday language, rather than changing or giving a kind of artistic deformation or of any sort of distortion. This next picture is also connected with Nekrasov, I Live and I See, because it's for both of them a kind of, they're actually Bulatov's words, but it's a kind of a motto, a kind of program of how they think and work. And this picture is painted from Bulatov's flat, from his studio, and it's just the words just are sort of saying, this is where I live and this is what I see, from his studio window.
Can I go back to, I mean, it applies to this painting as well, and we're talking about the visual form of representation is like a sort of a bland reproduction, which therefore doesn't require any special knowledge of art to actually read it and understand it. And I just would like to remember something that you've written, which I think relates to this. Every age has its own characteristic accumulation of platitudes. They reveal what people believe in, what they hate, and what they found disturbing. And you've talked elsewhere of a preoccupation with platitudes. Can you elaborate on this notion of what you mean by platitudes?
He says that every generation has things that it sort of seems to think are the most important things, and they get they may be completely meaningless or sort of banal, but they take on a very significant meaning. And but when you look back in the part to the things in the past, then each generation seems to be fixated with something completely stupid, and it just seems funny to us now. And what Bulatov tries to do is to see through our own preoccupations and see them, as it were, in retrospect, and to see how silly and fatuous they are as well.
But I presume he's referring to imagery that can express these platitudes or these preoccupations, and the imagery itself presumably functions as a sort of icon of those preoccupations.
Just for him, and the image is about it represents the thing that you understand, that if you understand something you can give it a name, and that is its image. And for Bulatov, painting is actually a way of coming to understand things, to think that the way we live, and because it's a way of stepping back a little, or stepping aside and taking an impartial view of things to understand. And also through painting you can learn to understand things and give things meaning that just disappear anyway through life and pass by, whereas in the painting they stay there and something of the truth.
This quote on the back of the catalogue I found very interesting, where you say that the picture is different. It is the only reality I trust and believe. The world around us is too active, too unstable for us to maintain any true belief in it. Everything is in a state of flux. Everything is changing. Only the picture is immutable.
This is that picture is the only thing that is really real, more so than a landscape or something. But it's like a symbol of it's a form of support. It's like a crutch. He can lean on his picture and trust it and feel supported by it in coping with the external life, and that's why it's very real to him.
So the paintings in a way again sort of function as metaphors for ideas about the world and about his own condition and relationship to the world.
Pictures aren't actually a metaphor for him, because they're just the way he sees things. They have an existence of their own. They are their own. They have a reality. So they're not. You know, they do have their own existence. But in them he depicts how he sees things. But they do have a kind of metaphorical element aspect as well.
Finally, I mean, this may lead on to it. I mean, how would he define sort of the artist's responsibility in relation to his work? I mean, does this suggest that there is a specific sort of responsibility that the artist has and exploring other kinds of realities through his work.
He is. He has to take complete responsibility.
How would he define that? I mean, what is being responsible as an artist?
So he has to answer for what he does and can't lie about it
or
tolerate lies
about it.
And that it doesn't have any, that there isn't anything false in the picture.
Now a series of interviews recorded at Art London 89, the fourth international contemporary art fair held at Olympia in London earlier this year. Well, now I'm talking to Roy Cook in the Mutomba Gallery stand here at the art fair. The Mutomba Gallery is from Harare, Zimbabwe, and it's a big stand. You have a lot of sculpture here. It would be interesting to hear from you. First of all, do you think it's served a purpose to be here at the fair? And if so, exactly what?
Well, we can always do better and we always hope for better, but we've had a very positive response from the people who've seen the show. I think for a gallery such as ourselves, a well-organized international art fair is very important. In fact, we'll be exhibiting at the Chicago International Art Exposition in May. The reason is that as a gallery we exist at the source of the art in Zimbabwe, but clearly Zimbabwe is not one of the major art centers of the world. It's not New York, Paris, London or whatever. So as a gallery we have to reach out, and thus art fairs well organized are an important element of our marketing strategy, if you like. We have a long-term concern to make the right sort of gallery connections, hopefully as a result of this sort of art fair, to give the work serious exposure. I think, in fact, international art fairs can serve a very important purpose. For example, I know for a fact that in recent international art fairs, including this one, we are the only gallery from Africa. I think there is often a very Eurocentric view of the art world which believes that contemporary art begins and ends in the West. We're here to dispel that notion. And I think for galleries such as ourselves, showing work which is not always given the fullest of exposure internationally, such events are an important way of making connections. Contemporary art in Africa is alive and well. And I believe that an international art fair that exhibits only work from Western Europe and North America or from Western cultures is in fact not truly international. It ignores the significant art coming out of the cultures of Africa and Asia and Latin America, for example. The art of Africa is alive and well today, as you can see from this stand.
Well, now I'm on the Holly Solomon stand and talking to Holly Solomon. Perhaps you could say what your reactions are to being here in London at this art fair.
Well, it's very exciting for me to be here, first of all because I like London so much. And I am an Anglophile, as I think most Americans really are. And it's been extremely well received, and I'm very, very pleased. Couldn't be more happy, really.
I'm very interested to hear that, because you have a really big stand here, so obviously you've made a big commitment to being here. So it's been successful then for you?
I think it couldn't be more successful. I've sold work, gotten shows for artists in Europe, had many inquiries, people do ask questions, they really care about art. There's a very large art community that really does care. You know, look at, we've been mobbed. We've had many, many people coming. Artists come. And from the continent, too. Italians are here. French people have come. So it's very good. It's a meeting. It should be a meeting place for everybody. And hopefully it will become that.
Were you here at the last fair? I mean,
No, this is my first fair here. Yeah, my first fair. And it's great. It really has been super.
Well, now I'm on the Karsten Schubert stand, and I'm I mean, I think it's very good that you're here in many respects. How have you found the fair from your point of view?
It was very interesting. There were lots of people around. Hardly any bias, that was the big problem. That had to do with the fact that the fair was sandwiched between Madrid and the Frankfurt Art Fair, which is in 2 weeks' time. And it didn't coincide with anything else in London, like the auction week or something like that. So lots of people from abroad were missing. Mm. And the other problem here was that most of the big local galleries, the contemporary galleries I'm talking about now, did not show.
Yeah. Now, that, I mean, I think that's very significant. I mean, you're here, but galleries such as the Lisson, Doffy, Anthony Reynolds clearly have not participated in it. Yeah. I mean, why do you think they've stayed away?
I suppose they felt that, you know, there is the timing was really bad for all of them, and so they just stayed away. Mm. But it will make it difficult next year to again, you know, they will again go to foreign galleries and say, please come, and they will say, oh, why should we support a London Art Fair if the local galleries don't support it? So, you know, the problem will be just dragged on another year.
But from the point of view of the sort of organisation of the fair, I mean, do you think that the fair itself should try and involve the key sort of local British galleries as a sort of a springboard to its entire organisation?
It should, and it should really invite, you know, the big galleries from abroad and give them free stands to just launch the thing properly. I mean, when you think about how Madrid was launched, there was unbelievable sums of money pumped in to actually make it work, and it now starts working. They can actually select the galleries they want to participate, which is amazing. Mm. So that guarantees a very high standard of quality. Here, they just try to get in anyone they can get in. There's no selective process. And I think at the beginning you have to be really generous and make people come you want here, even if it doesn't make you any money as the organizer.
Right. Now, there has been fairly massive publicity and promotion for this event. I'm thinking of the British Airways full-page colour ads and national newspapers and so on, and also the way in which they've assisted in all sorts of ways. I mean, what's your reaction to the sponsorship of this event?
It's fine. I mean, I don't care where the money comes from in the end. The press coverage, I thought, was rather bad. I mean, if you go upstairs to the press office and look at their billboard, it's unbelievably pathetic. There was nothing in the Sunday papers today, for example.
Which perhaps comes back to the problem about the commitment of British galleries.
British galleries, probably, yes.
We're now in the British Airways suite in Art 89, talking to Sue Welland from British Airways. Sue, you are?
I look after advertising and promotions in the UK and Europe. Also corporate sponsorship, which and we've developed a new policy for that over the last 6 months, which takes us over the next 3 years.
Now, the sponsorship of this event, I think, has impressed most people, and I'm thinking of the full-page colour ads with the Tony Cragg piece in the national press over the last week or so. I mean, it's a massive kind of commitment. First of all, I was interested to know why it is you selected contemporary art to be associated with.
Contemporary art, I think, at this time is taking, more and more people are getting interested in it, and therefore it gets more of our target market. It's right because it matches the style of British Airways, all the sorts of things that we are currently doing with First Class, with Club World and Club Europe, which are our business classes into Europe and international, are all about style, innovation, and the kinds of things that contemporary art are about as well. So therefore we feel that the match with contemporary art is right for British Airways now.
So how many years are you committed to sponsoring this event?
Well, I think if you're going to take sponsorship seriously, you don't just go in for ad hoc promotions. So we couldn't just look at the fairs in isolation or for 1 year only. What we've chosen to do is to go into contemporary art for the next 3 years. So that means that we've committed definitely to Los Angeles, which was in 88, London in 89, then we do Los Angeles in 89, London in 90, and then we're looking forward to Tokyo in 1990 as well. So it's a 3-year commitment.
And if you can say, I mean, what sort of annual cost does this involve British Airways in, this sponsorship deal?
That is a difficult question.
I thought it might be. I mean, clearly it's fairly substantial. I mean, I've mentioned the press, but there's all the things that have happened here at the art fair.
I think substantial is one of those nasty vague phrases that everybody hates. So I would say that we are spending well over £500,000 at least a year. That might be in direct fee, which is paid to the sponsorship organisations, but we are also matching that with promotional support. So you could say over £500,000, but it's a lot more than that because of all the marketing activity that we're carrying on around the fairs.
Perhaps it's too early to say, but how do you evaluate the success of this sort of a sponsorship scheme?
Well, I think the way that you evaluate things is through setting very clear objectives. With our sponsorship organisation, Karen Earle, who are working very closely with us, we have set clear objectives for individually each of the fairs, but then also the fairs over a period of 3 years. So what we're looking for from these first two fairs is, first of all, a recognition that British Airways are sponsoring it, and certainly we've achieved that, especially through this fair, but also through Los Angeles. Secondly, we're looking at data collection, so we can register the amount of people that are interested, British Airways, how often they fly, etc. And also through the amount of traffic that is being generated directly as a result of the fair, whether that is through galleries or exhibitors coming into London or going to Los Angeles, or whether it is people actually booking whilst they're here at the fair. So those are three very basic ways in which we're evaluating it. But then obviously one would take into account press cuttings, etc.
And now I'm on the stand of the British Airways Most Promising Artist Award, talking to two of the artists who are showing work here. And you are?
Anita Taylor.
Anita, what do you think this has meant as far as your future, your career, your work is concerned?
I think it's been very good as far as exposing the work either to the public or to the galleries. Obviously the value will be understood later through contacts made later, I think.
Yeah. And you are?
Kirsty Cohen.
Right. Kirsty, I mean, from your point of view, how do you view this whole event? Obviously there's a lot of hype and, you know, a lot of attention. What college are you from?
Glasgow School of Art.
So what has it meant to you?
Well, to come down to Olympia from Glasgow, as you say, the exposure is about the main thing. It's just been excellent in that way. Excellent. We couldn't, at this stage, and I think on all of our careers, couldn't have really asked for anything better at this stage to have this kind of exposure, and it just been seen, really. And just getting reaction from galleries, private collectors, etc., etc. So in that sense, it's great.
Do you think, I mean, the idea of a kind of competition of this sort goes slightly against the grain of being a practicing artist, or do you think it's something that you just have to accept as part of this whole process of visibility?
We've got to play it.
Sorry?
We're in the game and we've got to play along with it, I think. So we're going to take it as it comes and of course try and retain some, how would you say, Anita, integrity in all of this, because in a sense this situation that we're in just now is not a reality. It's not reality as far as any artist is concerned, not at all.